ladies and gentlemen. I'm Sam Roggeveen, Director of the International Security Program at the Lowy Institute. I'm only here tonight to help my colleagues here tell their story. And tonight we want to introduce you to the 2020 Asia Power Index, which ranks the relative power of 26 states and territories in Asia. We also want to give you a sneak peek of some related Lowy Institute research on global economic trends over the next 30 years. The Asia Power Index ranks 26 countries and territories in terms of their capacity to shape their external environment. The features of the website include an interactive map, a weightings calculator, network analysis. You can compare countries, you can drill down into and explore each indicator across multiple years. And it's a web-based feature that really establishes the Lowy Institute Power Index as an indispensable research tool for the study of power in Asia. And we're incredibly proud of it. And the 2020 edition, which covers 3 years of data now, is the most comprehensive one yet about the changing distribution of power in Asia. The project evaluates international power in Asia across 8 measures: military capacity and defence networks, economic capability and relationships, diplomatic and cultural influence, as well as resilience and future resources. And this year, the index includes 3 new indicators that track major ecological threats, defence dialogues, and perceptions of the international and domestic handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. And also, for the first time, Papua New Guinea has been included. Now, what we also want to do tonight is to preview some new research that we're working on called Who Will Rule the World? Scenarios for Global Power. Roland Raja will be presenting the initial results from his research, looking at the long-run growth projections for the US, China, and other key economies under various scenarios, and how the global balance of power might evolve. So my job now is just to introduce you to our 3 experts and then let them get this conversation underway. Hervé Lemayeur, to my immediate left, is Director of the Power and Diplomacy Program at the Lowy Institute and the driving force behind the Asia Power Index. Hervé joined the Lowy Institute from the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies. Alyssa Leng is a Research Associate in the Power and Diplomacy Program. Alyssa works primarily on the Asia Power Index, and she previously worked at the Australian Treasury and the Reserve Bank of Australia. And Roland Raja, down the end, is lead economist at the Lowy Institute. Previously, he was senior economist and country manager at the Asian Development Bank, and he also worked in Indonesia with the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Now, Hervé and Alyssa will first offer you some selected highlights from the Asia Power Index, followed by Roland and his scenarios for global power. After those presentations, I'll come back to moderate some Q&A, and my habit really is to involve you as much as possible. I'll be delighted to simply point to you for questions and not ask any myself. So as you listen, please do think about some of the questions you'd like to ask our experts. And then what I'll ask you to do at the appropriate moment is just to make your way forward to the microphone down there to ask your questions. That's what we're doing tonight rather than handing a microphone around. So, Hervé, why don't we begin with you and to take all of you through some key findings from the 2020 Asia Power Index. Would you please welcome Hervé?
Thanks, Sam. It's great to be back in Canberra, where life feels very normal, I have to say, although Sydney is also increasingly normal. I hope that you've all had your canapés, which is half the reason or more that you're here. It was a good incentive, or bribe, should I say. But now that you're here and I have your attention, I thought I would run you through the 2020 edition of the Asia Power Index. And seeing as economic power is a big theme of the night, seeing as we've got Roland in the room, who will be presenting a follow-on project that we're working on, I thought that I would begin setting the scene by showing you just how much the world has changed since 1995. And I think that is really the key to understanding the drivers of the shifting balance of power towards Asia and also within Asia. In 1995, four of the five largest economies were transatlantic. And they were the five largest economies were the United States, followed by four of its treaty allies. So this was very much the peak of the US unipolar moment. And it's amazing to see just how much the world has changed in 25 years. So China went from an economy about the size of Brazil, quickly eclipsed the United Kingdom and France in the mid-2000s. By 2009, actually eclipsed Japan as the second largest economy. India, a bit more of a laggard there, you see, but still experiencing its own economic miracle of sorts to such an extent that by 2019, India actually became the world's fifth largest economy at market exchange rates, because if you consider GDP using another measure, which is purchasing power parity, which takes into account the difference in, for example, labor costs, the fact that it's cheaper to build skyscrapers or ships in developing countries, then India is already the third largest economy. China is already significantly larger than the United States. That's the world as it stood in 2019 at the precipice of the pandemic. And that's really the story of what looked like the Asian century, one in which global wealth and power were shifting eastwards, and Asia had in fact been poised to become larger than the rest of the world economy combined by 2020. Of course, we've had the pandemic, and that's precipitated an abrupt turn of fortunes for everyone involved, but also for a number of our major Indo-Pacific players. What 2020 has done is really triggered a race to the bottom, where countries have competed with each other only by degrees of underperformance. So if we aggregate, I mean, we look at much more than just economic power alone, I should say. So if I take you to our wheel of power, you'll see that we look at economic capability, where we look at obviously market size, but also technology, connections to the global economy, and so forth. We look at conventional military strength. We take into account resilience, which is the capacity to deter real or potential threats to state stability. We also look at the projected distribution of future economic, military, and demographic resources, insofar as these things already shape the perception of power today. And it's not just what countries have, it's also what countries do with what they have in terms of their economic diplomacy, in terms of the defense networks, in terms of their diplomatic networks, and last but not least, in terms of their cultural influence. So across the board, we have about 130 indicators, 30,000 data points that go into any 1 year of the index. And the value in this exercise is that in that repeating it every year, we get a good sense of how the trends are playing out. So I might just take you to our PowerPoint presentation now. And once we aggregate all that data, what we get at the tip of the iceberg is a distribution of power that looks like this, where you see the United States and China. You're probably unable to read that from this distance, but you'll have to believe me that the two charts, the two bars at the far left, the United States and China, very much command the picture, but there are a number of other players that make up and sustain the Indo-Pacific. And we argue that every one of them, even the smallest one, Papua New Guinea, has a degree of agency that they can play and exert within the geopolitics of our region. The pandemic has, however, changed things. So every country in dark blue that you see in front of you, that's 18 of the 26 that we look at, registered a sharp downward shift in their overall power in 2020 relative to where they stood in 2019. So this is a race to the bottom. But none, no country registered as steep a fall in their relative power as did the United States in 2020. And that is actually rather shocking if you disaggregate the findings of the United States. You'll see that, I'm just going into the country profile here, that the US standing has waned in all but one of the eight core measures of power. A 10-point overall lead over China 2 years ago has been narrowed by half in 2020. And I think what we can more correctly describe our region as a bipolar region, dictated increasingly by regional bipolar disorder. That is the doctor's prognosis on what's happening. Now, the US is still ahead in terms of its military capability, its defense networks, its cultural influence. However, it lost the most points in measures in which China is already ahead, whether that's economic relationships, its economic capability, which is the one on the far left here, or indeed in terms of its diplomatic influence. So that is bad news because it's not just US influence that's diminishing, but even its overall resources and capabilities within Asia. There are some gains in its score, notably in terms of its resilience. You might ask, why is the US doing better in terms of its resilience in a year where there was so much political instability? But that really reflects the fact that the US has more energy security than it ever has before, or certainly in the last 70 years. The US has in fact become a net energy exporter, and whereas before it was chronically dependent on the Middle East for its energy supplies, which really embroiled it in a number of conflicts there. The coronavirus, which I think my colleague Alyssa will really explain in greater detail, but the coronavirus has contributed to a loss of US prestige for the United States, and that really points to the fact that legitimacy and leadership on the world stage starts first with the capacity of leaders to govern well at home. It testifies in equal measure to the consequences of a failure in US global leadership. So the election result may well change the narrative next year, but it has done significant damage to US standing in Asia. It's not been a good year for China either. However, I should mention that. And in fact, when we superimpose China's results over the United States, what you see is that China has stark strengths and stark weaknesses, and that overall the US still paints a more rounded picture in terms of its ability to project itself as a superpower in Asia. So China delivers inconsistent results. It's well ahead in terms of economic relationships, fractionally ahead in terms of economic capability, and in terms of our assessment of its future resources. China now wields a larger global and regional diplomatic network than any other country. That is to say, it has more embassies, more diplomatic postings than any other country, including the United States, not only in Asia, but worldwide. However, its diplomatic influence has in fact narrowed specifically in relationship to Japan. And it may well be that Japan overtakes China in terms of diplomatic influence next year. We'll have to see how that plays out. The other thing to point out is that Beijing has enhanced its military capability. It's invested in weaponry that could threaten US and allied bases in the region. Political will and defense economics will be deciding factors in the military rivalry with the United States. However, the Achilles heel for China is in terms of its defense networks. A lack of trust among 11 neighbors with whom China has boundary disputes and or legacies of interstate conflicts, such as India, Vietnam, and others, really undermines the potential for Beijing to replace Washington as the security guarantor in the region. Where you see the exceptions to that rule is in terms of places like Cambodia and Pakistan, where very much the your enemy's enemy is your friend rule tends to dictate the state of affairs, which is to say Cambodia has a troubled relationship with Vietnam, Vietnam has a troubled relationship with China, and that brings Cambodia and China together. Similarly with Pakistan in regards to India. Now let me quickly move we can discuss the economics here in the discussion, as well as the technological arms race between the US and China, which has actually widened, not narrowed this year. But let me move to Japan, because Japan is ranked third overall in our ranking. And that's surprising, given its diminishing share of economic resources, its military capability, which is really underdeveloped. And yet it is a consistent overachiever in terms of its cultural influence, in terms of its diplomatic clout, in terms of its economic diplomacy in places like Southeast Asia. And what that means is that we classify it as an overachiever. It does better
than what we expect in relation to its size and resources, better than any other country in the region in terms of its ability to convert its limited resources into broad-based influence. And that holds, but it will be a challenge given the recession has compounded the structural weaknesses of an aging economy. Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga has a real challenge on his hands in terms of stepping from the shadows of Prime Minister Abe, whose premature resignation may well be an inflection point for Japan. But suffice to say, for now, Japan remains a quintessential smart power in our region. Now, I want to turn my attention to India. I mean, one way you can actually also see this is in terms of online search interest, by the way, where we map all the search trends over across the region in every country to see which countries are the most popular among netizens across Asia. And consistently, we see that Japan, within that network analysis, sits in the middle of that web. But let me turn my attention to India. One of the indicators that we introduced this year is in terms of defense dialogues, so who does what with whom, how often, in terms of ministerial meetings, in terms of deepening often non-allied defense partnerships. What you see there in this web is that India has become very central to the diplomatic defense architecture of our region. Now, you might question whether that will hold, but it is a historic point of weakness for India. India has traditionally been much more non-aligned. It's opted for, historically, an equidistant approach between China and the United States. If anything, its best friend for a long time was Soviet Union, Russia, from which it continues to procure its arms. But what we see is a real, I think, sea change in the ability of India to associate itself more closely. It's not an alliance. I think that remains a taboo term in India, but associate itself more closely with the United States and other partners such as Japan and Australia through the quadrilateral grouping. So what we've seen India do is essentially improve its standing in terms of defense diplomacy, which is a historic area of weakness. But the caveat is that on economic diplomatic terms, in terms of its ability to integrate into free trade initiatives, there India has actually taken a step backwards. And it's interesting, in my conversations with Indian counterparts in government and in think tanks, there is this heated debate that we often have where India is saying, well, look, the world is becoming more protectionist. Why should we open up to the world? And that is perhaps a sound argument, but it also means that India is less able to influence its nearer broad in terms of its economic levers of power, less able to drive investment flows. And in places like Nepal, really on its doorstep, China has now become the primary foreign investor. So that is a negative trend for India, on top of which comes the fact that we've had to revise India's long-term economic growth forecast as a result of the pandemic, and Alyssa will touch on that. Now, I wanted to end by talking about three middle powers that really formed the exception to our rule of downward shifts in power, increased vulnerability as a result of the pandemic. There are only three countries, and two countries, one territory, that registered an upward trend in their overall power over this year, and they are Vietnam, Australia, and Taiwan, all very differently placed in terms of the overall ranking. You'll see that Taiwan here is ranked 14th. It's incredibly vulnerable in relation to China. Obviously, it is not a recognized nation state. It does not have diplomatic recognition in our region. Nevertheless, it's improved its reputation. It has also improved the diversification of its economic relationships. Vietnam is a classic case in point of a country that has done incredibly well over the 3 years that we have measured it. In fact, registering improvements across the years that we have undertaken the Asia Power Index. It is now just 1 point shy of Indonesia, which is saying a lot, given that Indonesia is the traditional leader of the ASEAN grouping. And Vietnam has really invested itself not only in terms of growing its economy, but also diversifying its diplomatic relationships, steering multilateral trade agreements, in particular the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. And I think all this is to say that basically in a situation where neither the US nor China can assert undisputed primacy in our region, the choices, the interests, the influence exerted by smaller players, in particular middle powers, become more consequential to the overall balance of power. And at the margins, even in terms of shaping the regional order, for Vietnam, that's certainly the case in terms of RCEP and the TPP, which has really steered. Now, Australia is the third country that registered an upward change in its overall power, and it's now become the sixth most powerful country in our region, eclipsing South Korea. We're not biased as an Australian Institute because last year Australia actually registered a downward shift in its score, so I think we are being even-handed. But I think what it reflects here is the fact that Australia, in many ways, is more nimble than its US ally at being able to forge defense diplomacy in the region, particularly with Southeast Asia, with countries like Indonesia and Vietnam, it at the same time has done very well in shoring up the economy in difficult times and in protecting itself from the COVID virus. So there's many reasons why Australia has done well, but I wanted to end by pointing to three potential vulnerabilities to look out for. The first is in terms of Australia's energy security. Australia remains the most chronically dependent country on energy imports, refined fuel imports, which is a vulnerability in cases of any disruptions in sea lanes of communication. The second is that if you look at where Australia is strong, it's in terms of its defense diplomacy. Where it could improve is in terms of its conventional diplomatic tools of statecraft, including aid. And what we've seen Australia do very well is in terms of consolidating its influence within its near abroad, within its Pacific family. The inclusion of Papua New Guinea has helped in that regard. But what we need Australia to do now is really step up in Southeast Asia as well. Finally, in terms of demographics, one of the great things about Australia is that it is one of the few developed economies to enjoy high productivity and still be growing its working age population. But that trend has gone negative this year. For the first year since the Second World War, Australia's migration intake has gone into negative territory. That is to say, more people left Australia than came into Australia. And that is really a recipe, if that trend continues, for producing a smaller, poorer, and ultimately less secure nation. So that trend will have to be reversed if Australia wants to continue to do well in the power index and in terms of its regional standing. So I'll leave it at that. As always, far too much ground to cover in a few minutes, but I'll hand over to Alyssa.
Great. Thanks, Hervé, for that. It's really nice to be here with everyone in person for a change. So as we've already talked about before, the coronavirus has already had a very large impact on power in Asia. Power doesn't normally shift this quickly, but it has in this case as a result. So I think it's worth thinking through exactly how it has done so, both in the here and now, as well as going forward into the slightly longer term. So in the short run, let me just pop on some slides. In the short run, the virus has already had impacts on countries' reputations, which flows into the diplomatic influence that they're able to wield on the international stage. So we measured this in the index this year by surveying a number of experts across the foreign policy community, as well as in the health and the epidemiology fields, to sort of understand what people thought of different countries' responses to the virus. So if you look at the top right corner of the chart over there, you see actors like Vietnam, Taiwan, and New Zealand handling the virus well in the eyes of these experts, and their reputations abroad improving. These are in the countries in the top right quadrant. See, on the other hand, countries who have struggled to contain the spread of the virus at home actually saw their reputations abroad get worse. The most significant of those is the US, who's right down there in the bottom left corner. And there's other big players there as well, including Russia and India. So interestingly, China is the only exception to this remarkably perfect rule. China's the only one in that bottom right corner of the chart over there. So though experts rated its domestic handling of the coronavirus to be above average compared to everyone else, its reputation overseas deteriorated anyway. There are a number of reasons for this. China's initial management of the pandemic, characterized through drastic restrictions on personal freedom, the suppression of information, all of these things sort of fed into pre-existing concerns about authoritarianism. Its wolf warrior diplomacy that followed that didn't exactly help either. And its attempts at mask diplomacy, at sending PPE and doctors around the world, appears to not have offset these factors. Going forward, though, China's reputation may be salvaged through vaccine diplomacy. A number of countries, including Malaysia and Indonesia in Australia's near vicinity, have already signed up for Chinese-made vaccines, which is important in a context where the US has not been looking out for everyone else. It's been looking out for itself first and has been much less present on the international scene. But reputations can and do change very quickly, as we've seen throughout the course of this year. So what about the longer-term impacts of the coronavirus on power? I think the clearest way to sort of consider this is through the economic impact of the virus going forward, since economic capability, in our opinion, is a key determinant of geopolitical power and can be projected forward more easily than the other aspects. So as we all know, all countries around the world, around the region, have suffered a significant economic hit as a result of the pandemic and the various measures that we've taken to slow the spread, including lockdowns, stay-at-home orders, so on and so forth. But the pandemic will continue to affect the balance of power going forward as well. Some countries are going to recover economically faster from the pandemic than others. And as a result, the relative amount of economic power nations hold in the region may change. I think the most acute example of this is China, of course, which health-wise has really managed to suppress the virus almost completely. This affords it two significant advantages. The first is the avoidance of long-term or permanent economic damage, and the second, being able to get underway with its economic recovery faster than almost any other country. Both give China an advantage in terms of their economic power going forward. Meanwhile, advanced economies like the US and Japan will likely take several years, possibly out until 2023, to recover to the size that they were in 2019. And the rise of other potential economic competitors to China, in particular India, is also likely to be delayed as a result of the pandemic. In particular, India stands to lose the most compared to what it could have achieved if COVID hadn't happened. On our forecasts, India will only reach 40% of China's economic size in 2030 in PPP terms, rather than 50% as a result of COVID. So what does all this mean? All of this points, in my opinion anyway, to the pandemic widening the gap in terms of economic size and economic power between China and a lot of the other players in our region in the immediate future. So despite the inevitable uncertainties associated with how the pandemic will evolve in the coming months, because of course it's still a live event, all this makes it very difficult to understate the importance of China and how central it will be in the balance of power in Asia going forward. So in light of this, I'll now hand over to my colleague Roland to take a longer-term look at the trajectory of the Chinese and US economies.
Thanks, Alyssa. So I'm going to be talking about the long-run outlook for the balance of power to 2050. As Sam mentioned, this is part of an ongoing research project that the three of us have been working on. It's not published yet, but we wanted to share with you some of the initial results. Now, of course, as the saying goes, forecasting is always difficult, especially when you're talking about the future. But we can add to that, especially if you're talking about the long run, and especially if you're trying to do so in the middle of a global pandemic. But from another perspective, it's actually easier in many ways, because what we can do then is we can sort of look beyond some of the short-term uncertainties and focus much more on some of the underlying trends and where we think this is going to be taking us. And in our analysis, we focus in particular on GDP as the single most powerful predictor of raw global power. So as you can see in this chart, GDP is strongly correlated with more complex measures like the Asia Power Index. But of course, what we would ideally like to be able to do is to be able to project the Asia Power Index into the future. That would be much too complicated, and so we have to focus on something. And as you can see here, GDP is a pretty good predictor if we're going to choose a single measure. And an important point here is that we focus on GDP at market exchange rates rather than on purchasing power parities, which is another measure, and for several reasons. I mean, as a standard measure of GDP, it does provide a measure of the resources available that can be invested in things like defense, science and technology, or overseas aid. But measuring this on market exchange rates better captures the power of a country in global markets, particularly in terms of trade and investment. And it also puts more emphasis on relative productivity levels, which is, of course, very closely related to overall societal and technological sophistication, which is in turn then closely related to a country's global power. One of the things I want to do in this presentation is pour a little bit of cold water on this idea that China is this unstoppable economic juggernaut and that it's set to sort of take over the world. And I'm going to try and do so in basically two slides. The first one's all about demographics. I mean, we know China's aging population is going to be a major drag on its future growth and status in the world. Between now and 2050, China's going to lose about 175 million workers. That's about a sixth of its workforce. That's going to directly subtract from its economic size, but it's also going to create a host of other social and public policy problems. So it's going, in particular, it's going to leave less resources left over to invest in growing the economy. And a key point here is that there's not a lot that China can actually do to avoid this outlook over the coming decades. Workforce decline is basically already baked into the coming decades. Even if China was able, even if it is as it is, loosening some of its family planning restrictions, this is not going to feed into the size of its workforce for another several decades, at the earliest in the 2040s. On top of that, while there are some things that China could do in order to try and improve workforce participation, the legacy of the planned economy in China basically means that workforce participation in China, including for women, is already quite elevated. So there's not a lot of scope to actually do better than what China is already doing when it comes to workforce participation. The other key part of the equation is productivity growth. So productivity growth is going to be key to China's future power status, but this is already on a sharply slowing trajectory. So productivity growth in China has been weakening sharply ever since the global financial crisis. That reflects the end of export-led growth. It reflects rising resource misallocation within the Chinese economy. But it also reflects the shift towards domestic consumption, which tends to be associated with slower productivity growth anyway. So although we tend to talk about shifting towards domestic consumption for China as a necessary thing for more sustainable growth, it's also a recipe for slower growth, and that's what we've been seeing coming through. And the result is that if we look at China compared to Korea and Taiwan, China's development path, its trajectory, is now well below those past Asian miracle experiences. It was performing like an Asian miracle economy before, particularly before 2010, but since that time, it's been moving onto a different trajectory. And in our view, that trend is likely to continue. So if you look at something like the dual circulation policy that has been recently been talked about, though we don't know everything about what that's going to mean, it largely seems to be about continuing down the path of focusing on domestic consumption and indigenous innovation. But this ultimately is a recipe for slower growth. On top of that, you have to put on the impact of technological decoupling, which will further hamper China's access to frontier technologies and slow down its productivity growth. And so overall, China's future growth would end up looking more like Malaysia's, as you can see in the chart. If that was to happen, that would actually still be a pretty good development experience. Malaysia has actually done pretty well in the historical record, but it will, of course, no longer be the kind of spectacular growth rates that China's been used to posting in the past. Putting this together, this is our baseline scenario for comparing the US and Chinese economies, gross domestic product measured in current US dollars. So as Alyssa mentioned, we see China recovering quickly from COVID, but ultimately then growth will slow to about 4.4% on average during this decade and 2.5% overall to 2050. And that growth will slow, not just because that's the trajectory that China is on, but also as it's a natural result as its economy gradually matures and as demographics start to bite. For America, we see America having a slower recovery, but at the same time, in the longer run, growth should return to basically the sort of pre-crisis trends, which over the long term will probably average somewhere around 1.7% in our take. So two key takeaways from this chart. One, the headline grabber is China will overtake America by roughly 2030. In fact, this is not something that I would consider particularly specific to our forecast. It's actually very hard to avoid something like this happening by roughly 2030 one way or another, given that China is already roughly 70% of America's size today. But the key thing that we take away from this is that the advantage that China will actually open up over America is actually not that large. You see in the chart, it's about 15% at its peak. And so if you put some perspective around that, in particular looking at this chart, thinking about the GDP advantage or deficit that one country has over the other, I think this really puts it into perspective. So if we go back to 2010, America's economy was 150% bigger than China's economy. And that was at the end of what most people considered to be America's unipolar moment. We fast forward to 2019, just before COVID struck, America's economy was still 50% larger than China's on this measure. And so what we're saying now is that China is going to reach a peak of 15% over the coming decades. To me, that says China is not going to enjoy the same kind of advantage, anything like the same kind of advantage that America did in the past. A Chinese century is not the most likely scenario, therefore. And instead, the more likely scenario is that the US and China will basically remain more or less equals for the foreseeable future. Now, the caveat is that this is only one scenario, and we think it's very important to think in terms of the full spectrum of potential possibilities, which is what this chart here tries to capture, which is what we see as the realistic best and worst case growth scenarios for the US and China. And in the interest of time, I just want to bring your attention to the key thing here being the high degree of overlap. And what this tells us is two key takeaways. One, that it's possible for America to keep pace with China's sheer size. But also, two, China's sheer size also means that it can remain a superpower even with relatively slow growth. And so the overall takeaway is that the future balance of power between the US and China, at least, is very much up for grabs, and it's going to be the domestic economic strength as well as the international policy choices which are going to be key in terms of determining the outcome of that contest. Finally, just as I move to close, it's worth saying something a little bit about what power in Asia will look like, which on these measures, at least, it will remain largely as contested as it is today. So in these charts, I'm showing you the relative size of the Japanese, Indian, and Indonesian economies compared to China's under various scenarios. And what you can see clearly is that, of course, Japan has been declining and continues to decline, but basically remains a major power within Asia for the foreseeable future. That is offset gradually by the rise of India to become a potential peer competitor with China, particularly around the 2040s. And meanwhile, if we look at a country like Indonesia, Indonesia's power basically remains intact. It's neither up nor down. It will remain in a similar position compared to China as it is today, at least in this kind of raw power terms, which is what we're trying to focus on. I consider most of what I said to be a kind of optimistic or benign take. You know, China is not on course to kind of dominate the world, at least in raw power terms. However, I still have to end on a somewhat cautionary note, which is that the next decade could be particularly dangerous. In this chart, what we're showing is the shift in economic weight from America to China. And what you can see is that around the GFC, of course, there was a very big acceleration in the shift of economic weight from the United States to China, and arguably that's been a key underlying driver of rising tensions over the past decade. Now, when we look forward, COVID-19 is going to be another one of those big shifts, and there's going to be another re-acceleration in the shift of economic weight from the US to China. That's not just about COVID-19, it's also just the fact that China is now so much bigger So growing fast really counts. Whereas if you look at the earlier parts of the chart, China was growing even faster, but the economy was so small it didn't really matter. The good news for the US is that this shift in power will likely ease by the mid-2030s. The bad news for everyone is that with the status quo shifting so rapidly, this could make for a very dangerous decade ahead or so. Thank you very much, and look forward to your questions.
Well, thank you very much to all three of my colleagues for fascinating and data-rich presentations. If there's an audience in Australia that is equal to it, it's got to be this one in Canberra, which is the centre of political power in this country. Some of you might remember, I think it's probably more than a decade ago now, the local government, the ACT, actually issued licence plates that said, had a slogan on the bottom that said, "Feel the power of Canberra." There was a huge, huge stink over that, and they had to withdraw them. I think they're collector's items these days. So, look, just to say again, if you have questions, just at any point, just make your way over to the microphone. Don't wait until one question has been answered. Just at any time, make your way forward. And if there's someone at the microphone already, please just make your way behind them and just keep a 1.5 metre distance and wait for your turn. So I'd love to take all of your questions, as many as possible, over the next sort of half an hour or so. I'm going to start myself, Roland, with you, if you don't mind. I think you've answered the question about where you see the projections over the next few decades, two or three decades, about the Chinese economy, and it implies I think certain assumptions or conclusions that you've drawn about the demographics issue, which you raised. Now I know that. You raise the point, and I think many economists make it, that China is about to hit a wall. The working age population is going to go into decline. But there are, I think, a sizable minority of economists who would argue that this won't matter very much because there's still so much productivity to get out of the working population that actually will make up for any decline in the raw number of working age people. So I just wonder where you stand in that debate about the demographics, the demographic crunch that's coming to China.
Yeah, thanks for that, Sam. I mean, I think in a very basic sense, and that's why I sort of showed those two charts, economic growth is driven by the demographics and productivity, right? Those are the two key elements of the equation. A lot of people, for example, want to say that China can keep growing the way Korea and Taiwan did. Right, when they were at a similar stage of economic development, roughly about one quarter of America's level of productivity, Korea and Taiwan basically grew for another two decades at 8%. So some economists want to say that, well, then therefore, if you want to talk about China's maximal growth performance, it could also grow at about 8% over the coming decades. But bringing it together with the demographics, you can immediately say that that's, at least in terms of, if we think those historical comparisons are the sort of basis for thinking about these sorts of things, well, then China's facing a completely different situation. Back then, when Korea and Taiwan were posting 8% growth, they were still in the demographic dividend stage of things. Their workforces were basically growing at about 1.5% on average over the next three decades. By contrast, China's is going to shrink by a little over about 0.5% each year. So that's 2 percentage points of difference, basically, each year. Basically, it explains why China can grow at 6% maybe at maximum, but not at 8%. So right there in demographics, there's a massive difference between what the past Asian miracle economies were able to do and what I think is a fair consideration of what China's maximum is. Mm. Now, in the results that I showed you up there, I mean, we don't have China growing like Korea or Taiwan in terms of its productivity performance because, as I showed you, actually that's not the trajectory that China is on. It's well below that, in fact.
And we should stress, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is essentially baked in, right? There are no policy decisions that the Chinese government can make to change this trajectory over the next two or three decades, things like changes to the one-child policy, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, they've already changed that. They've moved to a universal two-child policy. It's not really had any discernible effect, according to the studies that have looked at that. And that's because, you know, family preferences have also changed in China, partly, no doubt. Now, they could pursue that more aggressively, but one way or another, that's not going to affect China's working-age population until the 2040s. Even if China was to do a pretty heroic turnaround in its fertility rate, it would only slow down the decline in its working-age population in the 2040s, not actually cause it to stabilize or grow. The other option is lifting labor force participation. But as I said, even for women, labor force participation in China is one of the highest in the world, so there's not a lot of scope for doing that. That doesn't mean they shouldn't do those things. It doesn't mean that doing those things wouldn't be good for China's economy and probably its status in the world over the long term. But I don't see it as being able to substantially change this picture of demographic decline.
Now, I may have said earlier that we have about half an hour for questions. It's actually closer to 15 minutes. So if you have a question, please don't be shy about coming forward. So please.
Thanks. John Blackson from ANU. Look, really enjoyed the presentation. I love your work. Three triple barrel questions, I guess. Firstly, Canada is in APEC and the East Asia Summit, not in your survey. It's next door to the US. It's as much into the Pacific as the United States. I wonder why you don't put that one into the equation as well. Secondly, on Indonesia. We've been talking about Indonesia as eclipsing Australia in the next decade or two. We need to brace ourselves for dramatic change. That graph you showed doesn't seem to suggest that's going to happen. So I'd welcome your thoughts on what's happened, why are we not expecting that anymore. And the third one is ASEAN. I know people don't like to talk about ASEAN too much, the broken reed, as Peter Varghese calls it. But it, nonetheless, I would put to you that it doesn't help that we disaggregate it statistically in our minds. And if we were to aggregate it, it would be interesting to see how it looked compared to India, Japan, China. I was just doing a quick arithmetic on my head while I was looking at there, and it looked considerably larger than India on a couple of those graphs. So I wonder if you could comment on those three. Thanks.
Hervé, do you want to have a go?
Yeah, look, we've got to draw the boundaries somehow on Canada. The US is involved because it's a major external strategic partner. The East Asia Summit is at the crux of our determination of why, for example, Russia is in and not out. As far as I'm aware, I don't think Canada is the East Asia Summit, is it? And then I can point to various other forums in which it's not involved. But the point is, I mean, look, the French also have, they're in the queue for acceptance into our index. Those may well come over time, but at some point we want to also respect the fact that this is still centered geographically on Asia, that a lot of countries, and Russia is probably the biggest, Russia is a misfit middle power in our region. I mean, they're not happy to be called a middle power, but there's a very good reason, and that's because they have concentrated their assets, their relationships, primarily on Europe and even the Middle East, more so than they have in Asia. They have a Pacific fleet in Vladivostok. They're kind of, that's right. But so it is arbitrary, I'll grant it, but we had to draw the boundaries somewhere, and that's why Canada's not in, but I'll have another look.
The reason why, one of the reasons why it's useful is because it's so similar to Australia in so many ways.
Yes, but minus its own sphere of influence because it's surrounded by Alaska and the US. Yeah, that's right. On your point about what was your second point? I mean, I know ASEAN,
Indonesia.
Indonesia. Well, I mean, perhaps the economists can answer that, but I would argue that Indonesia has always been either the big source of it's been a source of fascination for Australia for time immemorial, either as a source of fear or as now a source of this is going to be a potential partner with whom we can ally. The fact is, they're still an incredibly inward-looking country, protectionist. we can argue about why the raw resource base isn't bigger than it is, but I will also say that on a number of other metrics, it is underperforming, and certainly under President Joko Widodo, you don't have a leader who is very externally minded or particularly ambitious. Now, when it comes to ASEAN, I fully agree. I'm a Southeast Asianist, committed, and I do think that there is ASEAN does certain things incredibly well. Obviously, it will never act with one voice. The ability for it to have a one-size-fits-all strategic doctrine for dealing with the great powers, US and China, was never the case and looks even less likely now. But given the fact that it's so riven by geopolitical differences, by Cambodia on the one hand, Vietnam on the other, I think it's actually remarkable that these smaller players are capable of not only banding together, but also influencing how other great powers deal with the region, particularly when it comes to the economic rules-based order, which is an incredibly important variable of power. It's not just military power. That's what we remind the Indians all the time. It is about economic power. And in a situation where China has asymmetric economic clout, the best antidote to the Belt and Road Initiative, to the sort of ad hoc bilateral relationships that China prefers, is multilateralism, and that is really coming out of ASEAN more so than it is coming out of any other regional grouping or major actor. So I'm actually a big optimist in ASEAN. We do factor that in individually within each country, so we don't just look at what countries have, but also what they do with what they have, their interrelationships. And ASEAN is a big reason why most of the Southeast Asian countries end up being overachievers, because they invest in that form of diplomacy. And they're more willing, they're more able to invest in relationships.
Alyssa, I think you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I'll just jump in shortly on the ASEAN point. Of course, it is important to consider them as one body, but of course you have such a diversity of powers within it in terms of how powerful they are, where they derive their power from, and so on and so forth. So I think it's important to consider both of them as a group and individually to sort of establish the merits on both sides. And I do agree that ASEAN countries working together does generate a multiplier effect in that their economic relationships mean more for their power than their individual economic weight.
Please.
Thank you all for a very fascinating discussion. My name is Hunter Marston from the Australian National University. A couple of quick questions. First for Hervé on the idea of bipolarity. I think it's interesting you characterize Asia as bipolar, because it seems so many people, scholars and analysts these days, are saying it's a multipolar region. The diversity of countries and rising middle powers that Alyssa's presentation also showed seems to indicate that it's more complex than just the US and China. Could you speak a little bit to that, and if a bipolar or multipolar order is inherently more dangerous than the other? And then for Roland, dangerous decades ahead. I'm wondering exactly what you would see panning out, or if you'd decline to go into that as an economist, what does perhaps history show about sort of narrowly rising GDPs and competition between great powers in Asia? Thanks.
Well, Hervé, why don't you go first? Maybe bipolar is just a comment on the psychological state of the region.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have two very big words for this, and the flip side, they're the same thing, but there are two ways of looking at it. One is regional bipolar disorder, that is to say there is no stability in the way that we saw during certain eras of the Cold War. Don't forget that after 1945, both superpowers were incredibly fatigued by the experience of global war, and in no position to really fight an all-out war amongst themselves. So that's why, it was to an extent, that's also why that we saw those proxy conflicts. I don't think neither the US nor China has really agreed on a settling point. That's taboo on both sides. The US thinks that it can somehow maintain its unipolar moment, or actually forge a Cold War that will resolve in the same outcome as the one that prevailed over the Soviet Union. China is more competitive economically than the Soviet Union ever was, so it's going to be a very different kind of Cold War, and it's a lot more unstable. Now, the second way of describing that is asymmetric multipolarity, which is to say that in a situation where neither the US nor China has undisputed primacy, where both are losing influence and clout, where both are viewed with wariness, where the region is, and the world really, is less ideologically driven and more driven by economic advantage, and that whilst globalization will continue and maybe a more hazardous variant of globalization, but decoupling will not end globalization or interdependencies. In that sort of world, middle players become more consequential. Their interests, their choices become more important. And so I do think that within a fluid balance of power between the US and China, highly contested and gray zone, really, that smaller players can exert influence. Now, the region doesn't really become truly multipolar until the 2040s, is what our forecasting suggests. I think when future generations, and I can say this because we're all not going to be here anymore in 2100 and whatever, 50, but when they study our century, they'll probably look back at the century as having been a multipolar one. But we're in that awkward phase now where it's the dying embers of the US unipolar moment. We're going to have regional bipolar disorder, and then that's going to move into some form of multipolarity, but only well into the sort of 2040s. So we've got to wait a while.
Yeah, I mean, I think Hervé in many ways sort of indirectly answered the second part of the question as well about why the decade ahead will be kind of dangerous. As an economist, I'm tempted to simply defer to Hervé's answer there. But I mean, from my perspective, and because you gave me that out, from my perspective, I think the key thing here is that you can have a misreading of the situation, right? In our view, based on the analysis that we've done, China's sort of the acceleration in China's favor is going to peak over the next 15 years or so, and then it's going to plateau right into a more stable situation. Now, we said that's just one scenario, and there are many scenarios, but that's the central tendency. Right? You can think of a bazillion different scenarios that you want, various degrees of difference, but the central tendency is around something that looks basically like that. And I think the risk is that you can get mistakes on both sides. Right? America in particular, and maybe the West more broadly, will misread this, just like there were concerns about Japan's rise, which from an economic perspective was inherently limited. But you can have this kind of misreading that these gains in China's favor are going to continue forever, and therefore we need to do something now in order to contain and stop this trend from continuing. That's probably going to be the wrong strategy. And then from the other end, you can have hubris on the side of the Chinese side, right? Thinking that their economic model is better, that their rise is basically baked in, and this is just going to continue, and the good times are just going to keep on rolling, not really realizing that actually most likely scenario is that just like all economies, as they mature, growth slows down, and China's economy, as I said before, is already not in that upper echelon of Asian miracle economies anymore. So mistakes are possible on both sides, and the pressure is going to be on over the coming 15 years or so.
Samba, Treasury. Apologies if this is retreading ground after the previous question. But as you noted, like, the US's power is waning. How do you see their role in the region moving forward, especially with a president who's potentially more outward-looking? Do you see them more as trying to exert more active diplomatic influence through trade deals such as they did with TPP, or do you see them as kind of a floating good guy backing their allies in the region militarily and economically, and how each scenario would affect the power balance in the region?
Any of you could answer that, but it's probably worth stressing that when we say US power is waning, we only mean that in relative terms, don't we?
Yeah, we haven't factored in their complete implosion. but you're right. So in relative terms, I think I would say that the US's power is normalizing. It's a less exceptional power, but it remains indispensable to the overall balance of power. What it does now, the cards it chooses to play are going to be hugely consequential for the rest of the region, not just for itself. And the first thing you want to do is stabilize basically the U.S. role as a diplomatic leader in the region, as a multilaterally inclined power. The one comparative advantage that the U.S. still has and will probably continue to have if it chooses to exert it over China is its network power. And that's not just in terms of its alliances, but that's in terms of being the beneficiary of a system of multilateral rules and norms and institutions that it's built over many decades, and it would be really a terrible thing for it to squander that, but it would also be a terrible thing for the region in terms of portending greater instability. So yeah, I think the US can stabilize its position. It can forget about the status quo ante, where there's no return to a position where the US is the uncontested unipolar power, but it can certainly play its weight. But how you manage that psychologically is really important, because you're right, China has the momentum, it will continue to have the momentum psychologically for the next 15 years. The US has inertia, basically, and how do you present inertia as a continued strength? So psychologically, this will be very difficult for them to deal with, but as soon as they've got their message across, they can still be a very consequential player. And in fact, their withdrawal, which would be a political choice, not a structural inevitability, would be disastrous. So they remain really indispensable.
Hmm. I just add there. I mean, I think one of the risks to me is, that the America goes back to a sort of same old playbook, though, so to speak, right? I mean, I think obviously there's this whole thing about how China has changed over the last, five or so years compared to the last Obama administration, and everyone's attitudes have hardened and blah, 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 right? But the number one thing I hear about, or you do hear about, is will America rejoin the TPP, CPTPP, right? I mean, I would say hopefully that they do, and people are at least talking about it in the sort of democratic ranks, which suggests maybe it's possible. But I would say it's not really a game changer. I think the whole thing was overhyped to begin with. That was the main US policy response in order to, sort of ward off China, in order to try and write the rules of the region, and draw countries closer to itself and its preferences. I think it was wildly overblown to begin with. And if America does join the TPP, we wouldn't really see a great deal change. There'd probably be some excited reporting about this and some pats on the back and so on and so forth, and then nothing changing, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one of the key risks, is that people have recognized that there is this problem. They do want to have some sort of different strategy, but the different strategy is not that different from the old strategy in reality. And so you're really just only marginally improving things and not really dealing with the actual problems that are out there.
Yeah, I'd add just one little addendum to that. I think the US is probably still going to be obviously important in the region, but I think there may be a little bit less patience on the part of countries in the region to sort of listen to the US opining on democracy, and after all that we've seen in the last few weeks. And on top of that, Biden's going to have to deal with living in Obama's shadow in terms of the foreign policy actions that it takes. So I think it, of course, has a still very important role to play, but somewhat constrained by these parameters on the outside.
We're out of time, but I'd like to get to one last question, please.
Well, Prue Gordon from the Australian Centre for International Trade and Investment. The question was just answered, actually. I was going to ask about RCEP and the TPP. Roland's indicated that you don't think it's going to have any material impact on going forward, and I imagine with RCEP that will have even less impact in terms of China's outward expansion and its relationships with its neighbours.
As people say, the RCEP is a less high-quality sort of deal, but it's bigger. I think it's where it's going to have an impact, which will be quite consequential, is Japan and Korea, right, who are in the agreement. There's no bilateral agreement between those three. So that's new trade liberalisation there within RCEP. That's going to be important. And, of course, if we're talking about balance of power and we're talking about China, well, China is the one that's going to be one of the three that's really going to benefit from that arrangement. This is not to say that, RCEP or TPP are not worth doing. And as an economist, I do believe those gains are worthwhile. People might say 1 or 2 percentage points of GDP, that's not very big. Yeah, we'll point to any other policy change you can make where the gains are actually much bigger than that. There aren't many. So it's still a worthy thing to be doing. Both will reshape supply chains to some extent, but I don't see either of them as game changers. We have the CPTPP. It's about half as big without the Americans. I don't see anything particularly changing to any great extent since that came on board. We've already got 90% of RCEP through a range of other free trade agreements that are already in place. I don't see that as shifting. It was already Factory Asia, right? I mean, we're talking about supply chains. It was already Factory Asia. We're not going to start crediting Factory Asia to RCEP now just because that's the latest trade deal that's on the blocks. So they're good things. They're just not game changers.
I'm a bit more optimistic about that. I mean, I think geostrategically it matters more than economically. It is about the rules of the game and who creates them. And I think that that is important from a geostrategic as opposed to just a GDP enhancing kind of measure.
And we can argue about it after.
Now, all these folks have warm meals waiting for them at home, so we're going to have to cut it short there. Could you please thank my three brilliant colleagues? Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. It's great that so many of you could be here, and we look forward to seeing you here the next time.